Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia, and all the way from Jerusalem, I have with me Hamutal Ghouri. Hamutal is a cultural critic, a consultant, and a transformative storyteller. Welcome, Hamutal.
Thank you, Magda, and thank you for having me on your podcast.
The people that know me, they must know that you're one of my ideal guests because I think storytelling is what represents me. Storytelling in all its form, whether I'm telling a story or I'm listening to a story or I'm creating a space for stories. Do you want to say a little bit more about yourself or should we go straight into the conversation?
Well, maybe let's go straight into the conversation and I will weave in more about myself as we go along.
Why is storytelling important?
Ah, amazing question. Wonderful question. So I will tell you why I became a storyteller. And this will also provide more information about me, but also why I think stories are, you know, the best thing after sliced bread or something. So I started, I became, I, you know, we all have stories to tell and we all love listening to stories, right? It's part of our, I think, DNA as human beings. But I became a storyteller and I became sort of passionate about transformative storytelling for two different reasons that ended up being intertwined. One of them was that some more than 20, almost 30 years ago, I was the director of donor relations for a foundation. And part of my job was to take donors around to site visits, to visit organizations that the foundation supported. And we would be there visiting this amazing organization, which I knew was doing amazing work. But somehow, when they described their work to the donors, they always kind of downplayed, you know, the amazing work that they're doing and its impact. And so I started developing tools for stories for organizations to better tell their stories. I would always tell them, don't provide me with a laundry list or, you know, of your activities. Tell me why this matters. Tell me about the difference you're making in the world. And so that was one reason, because I was really committed to helping organizations better tell their stories. And the other reason is way more personal. My eldest son was sexually abused as a child. And I, at the time, or several years later, I was doing this course on feminist analysis, critical analysis of folk and fairy tales. And I rediscovered the magic of folk and fairy tales, but also the extent to which so many folk and fairy tales, especially of the oral traditions, were about the abuse of children and domestic violence. And so I wrote this research paper about the healing power of folk and fairy tales,
which I hope you will be able to send to us as a PDF or as a link to read.
I'll send it to you as a link. It's available on my blog, but I'll happily send it to you. But it was really about, so how can folk and fairy tales help empower and heal children and adults who were sexually abused or who faced terrible violence? And it was, so at some point, the two apparently very different reasons. One was like professional, you know, providing organizations with the toolkit
or the
treasure box of how to tell their stories and how to help individual tell stories as part of their healing process, kind of came together. And for the last, I don't know, 20 years, I've been training groups, organizations, including business organizations, but also individuals who are coping with post-trauma.
And you certainly live in an environment that needs that.
Oh yes.
Don't we all? Most of us do, but we don't realize it, but you more so.
Yes, very much so. On the individual level and on the collective level.
Yeah,
But
exactly.
so how to tell their story as part of their journey towards healing? And I've done that before October 7th. Both individual work with survivors of terrible violence in childhood, but also with I do a lot of work with the bereaved family circle, the Israeli-Palestinian Forum of Bereaved Families. So trauma caused by the conflict and by loss, and these are Israelis and Palestinians who have lost their loved ones to the occupation and to the conflict and to the violence, the political violence. And I always say, that I have developed over the years this very rich sort of toolbox of how to tell your story in different ways and how to help, first of all, how to make sense of our own story before we even share it with anybody. This toolkit is really about making sense of our own stories and our own lives and then telling a new story. But I honestly think that the most important storytelling tool is, I call it formative listening.
It's like active listening, or is it something different?
So I guess it's like radical, radical active listening. Formative listening, because when I started writing down my thoughts about storytelling and trauma, so what trauma does is that it destroys language, basically. It destroys our language, it robs us of our language, it robs us of our words, both physical trauma and emotional trauma. And then the healing process is about refinding language. And I do a lot of work with especially particularly poetry. There's a cultural critic, but so from not being able to speak, so being muted, to what I call representative language, which is when we turn to art to express what we are unable to express at the moment. And this is where art in all its forms, poetry,
Exactly.
literature, visual arts, whatever, dance, music for sure, is a language. But so representative language is when we turn to art to help us express the feelings that we are unable to put into words. And then there's formative language, which is when we do find our own words. We're recreating our language. And so formative listening is essential to the creation of formative language. And it's not just about actively listening. It's transformative and it's formative because it's about withholding almost everything except deep compassion. Okay? It's withholding judgment, withholding the urge to give advice. Or even provide positive feedback. I did this session with women survivors of October 7th attacked, and they were, and there was a lot of crying and laughing going on in that session. And one of them said, "I can't stand it when people are telling me you are such a lioness. You are such an amazing force of nature." She felt that this was condescending.
I agree. I agree.
It's so formative listening is really about withholding almost any action that we are often compelled to take when we're listening to someone's story, especially if it's a very difficult story to listen to. Okay, so withholding judgment, withholding the urge to give advice, to provide positive feedback, to say, yes, but you'll see things will be better. No, it's really being like a very present witness and to feel honored to be an active witness. Because at the end of the day, what people, especially people who suffered a terrible trauma, they need to know that they're being heard, that they're being seen. And the rest of the work,
Will come later.
they will do it. And the thing is that it is extremely difficult to do, not because we're bad people, because we're good people most of the time, and most of us are good people. And when we are listening to a really difficult story, okay, of something really terrible that happened to someone, terrible violence, abuse, etc., it's difficult to listen, and we somehow want to push it away, or we want to get to the part with the good, the happy ending. And stories of trauma, they don't always have this fairy tale happy ending of happily ever after. And so formative listening is really about being present for another person.
But I've also, if I we take it back to the personal, my son's adopted. Okay, and it's not this, it's a trauma, and it. I don't know where I found it in me. I didn't have a lot of help, but I had a lot of maybe it's because I just love my son. But it took a lot of conversations of just letting him get angry and letting him ex say, why did she leave me?
Yes.
And why is she such a horrible person? And it's a case of just of not feeding into the trauma, but letting him be angry. Because there was time afterwards to say, it's okay to be angry. Not it's okay to be angry. She made that decision. We're never going to know why she made that decision. Look at now. You've got this gorgeous mom, and I used to try and lighten it because I think that's human nature to not keep it in the negative. I said, and look at this gorgeous mom you've got now. And the ultimate result of that was that when we had a few more difficult conversations, he would come to me and he would say to me, Mom, I want to try and find her, but I don't want to upset you because I adore you. I said to him, Dude, curiosity is a natural thing. You want to find her, I would feel the same way. You want to find her, we'll go together. I know you love me. Let's push that out. The curiosity is normal, and it took a lot of honest conversations and conversations where I just let him be angry or ask the difficult questions to me, and me reaching down in deep into me and being honest, because honesty, when there's a question and answer period in this trauma, unless you're honest, it doesn't work. And when you're not honest, it's obvious. And I think just the fact that I said to my son ultimately, he said, do you want to meet her? And I said, you know what? Yes and no. Not really, but she gave me the gift of you. So, yes. But I think the fact that he heard in me the doubt that there wasn't one answer, there wasn't a right answer, he saw that I was also not sure, which meant that it was okay for him also to not be sure. And I got the ultimate compliment 10 years later to say, you know what, Mom, you handled my being different beautifully. I said, what is diverse about you? He says to me, well, I rest my case. So it is, I mean, it's a difficult, you've got to be consciously aware that you mustn't automatically say it's going to be okay. You've just got to let them be angry or sad or cry or shout in that moment. And as you said, going forward, you will get to that space where they will come back and ask you for a reaction or ask you how you feel.
I think one of the key roles of parenting, or being positive presence as an adult in the life of a child is when you allow them to deposit their difficult feelings and emotions, their fears, their anger. You allow them to deposit these feelings and you keep them and you hold them for them until the moment when they're ready to take these feelings and process them on
Yes.
their own. And this is, this is what adults who love children. This is one of our roles as adults who love children, and who care about children, is to, it's like you're a deposit box.
Yes.
and you say, it's okay, you can dump this on me right now, and I will keep it and process it for you until a time when you feel that you can take it back. And I think that the more we love the children, the more difficult it is. Because, with my children, I always have to remind myself that no matter, the most difficult things that are happening to them, this is happening to them, not to me.
Yes.
And as you know, and making the separation, saying they are now going through this really rough patch, and I'm there
Hold the space.
to hold the space, and but this is not happening to me, right? And so I think again, so formative listening is really about overcoming the very human urge, to make this about us, basically.
Yes, bring it back to me.
It's really about not making this about us, but being fully present or as fully as possible present for the other person. And the truth is, I always say, I rarely give advice because I think advice is what I think I would have done if I was in the other person's shoes, but I am not in their shoes. And even if I was in a similar situation, it still wouldn't be the same. And so I rarely give advice, and I often think that when we provide the space for someone to just, download, sometimes listening to themselves, they already figure it out. Okay.
In talking to you, they figure it out. If you actually give them the space
Very often
in
that's what happens.
inventing and talking and speaking and rationalizing with themselves, as long as they've got the space and someone actually just there and present and making the space safe, and ultimately they reach the point where they've worked through some of it, or at least some of it.
Yes. So I think, that for the last few years I've been doing work, as I mentioned, with adults who suffered terrible, both men and women, who suffered terrible abuse in childhood, sometimes from the people closest to them, right? The
Often.
people who betrayed their trust in the most painful way. And I'm always so deeply inspired by, I'm always deeply inspired by the human soul's capacity to sort of stretch itself, right? There's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful quote by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross about beautiful people. I'll read it to you so that I don't misquote, but it's really one of the I use it so often with the people I work with. So the most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of the depths. These persons have an appreciation, a sensitivity, and an understanding of life that fills them with compassion, gentleness, and deep loving concerns. Beautiful people do not just happen.
That's lovely.
So as I mentioned, I was doing this bibliotherapy. It was basically like a bibliotherapy session for survivors, women survivors of the October 7th Hamas attack. And they kept saying, and with humor, like the worst reactions that they're getting for people post October 7th. So one of them said, "I can't stand it when people tell me, 'Oh, you're such a shero, you're such a lioness.'" Or another person said, "When people go, 'Can I have a hug? Can I give you a hug?'" Or one of them mentioned that her boss told someone else, "So do you know that she's a survivor of October 7th?" And she didn't ask her whether she wants to,
Spread the word.
share this information. And at some point, I told them, "I understand that I need to not say anything. It's the safest thing." But we were joking. There was a lot of humor in the room. But at the end of the session, all I did was read the Hebrew translation of this beautiful quote, and they loved it. And, because it wasn't about, it was this beautiful thing that said, "You are truly beautiful people. Not because you have superpowers or because you're, but because you have known suffering and because you have known defeat and because you have come back from the depth, from the abyss." And so, yes, so I think that and it's a journey. It's like exercising. It's like a muscle. You have to constantly.
Work at it.
Yes.
And I think that that's the problem we have here in Cyprus. We have an ongoing conflict since we're at 1974 or 63. And there has never been a space for anyone to tell their story, especially the women. I mean, in 74, there were rapes, okay? The only acknowledgement that there were rapes was that the Cyprus government changed the law to say that with the rape you can get an abortion. The women that were raped were taken to one of the British bases where there was a hospital to have an abortion and brought back to the refugee camps, which means they were stigmatized.
Yes.
So the story was never told. And then about 10 years ago, and we're talking about 40 years down the line, there was a raised awareness. I don't know why the women's organizations delayed or who delayed. And the health ministry sent a letter to all the rape victims that so that they could get a benefit, they needed to send proof of rape. And then they realized what they had done. Okay, 40 years later. So the stories are only now being told, and they're being told privately, which is fine, but it's not only the rape victims that have stories. It's displacement, it's losing a member of your family. We have a lot of missing, and there isn't no one. It's only recently that it's people have come to realize that unless you give me a space to tell my story, to be heard, to know that you're listening, I can't move on to peace. This has got to come out of me. This has got to come out of me. The load has got to come out of me. And it's the only way I can heal my way towards peace. And it's what you said earlier, it's the individual and the collective. Because if I do it and you do it and someone else, then it's the collective that's healing. It can't just be me. It's got to be There has got to be a space, and we need to, it's got to be for men and women, because men have the other issue of they're not allowed to tell stories and have emotion because it's not masculine. Boys don't cry or men don't get hurt. So I think this is one of the reasons our conflict is ongoing and the community is not ready to move back together, is because there's very little real conversations or giving a space for people to tell their stories and be heard. To say, for them to say, I hurt, it hurt, it injured me, it affected me. I needed to work through it and it affected me, which means it affected my children if I had children, and my husband if I had husband, or my family. So there's got to be that. It's only recently that storytelling has also got a better reputation, because people associated storytelling with Hans Christian Andersen and Aesop's Fables, which are very good, by the way, but they associated with telling children stories at night. They didn't want to acknowledge that each of us have at least one story in us, at least.
So I think what you said is so rich, and it touches on, I think, several points. One is that, gazillion years ago, more 36 years ago, I was sent by a temp agency to work for an organization that was doing capacity building for social change groups, and on the wall was a poster with an African proverb that said, until the lions have their historians, tales of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. And I think that this was when I was first baptized into storytelling and I didn't even know it. But I was reminded of that because the truth is that stories of war and conflict and violent conflict are never, almost never told by women. And if they are, there's a novel by Pat Barker called The Silence of the Girls, which is a sort of, it's a rendition of the Iliad, right? But through the eyes of women.
What's it called? The
And
Silence of the Girls, by whom?
by Pat Barker. And so it's really all about, as you said, terrible sexual violence and trafficking, and the novel ends with very powerful words. Now my story can begin. Now my story can begin. So first of all, women's stories about war and violence and violent conflict are rarely told. And if they are, they're told only through the eyes of women as victims of the violence. So that's one piece. The one piece is, that raising the voices of women, of children, about war and about the need to and our commitment to end wars and to end violence. The second thing is, and this became a very salient point post October 7th and since then, though in Israel at least, but also in other parts of the world, when it came to sexual violence, or sexual violence perpetrated in the context of violent conflict, violent national political conflict, there was this understanding that it takes years until the victims speak up. And the example was that, the survivors of the Holocaust, the Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, but also other survivors of Nazi Germany violence, only spoke of sexual violence in the camps or also by the liberating armies decades after it happened, because of the stigma, because of the shame, because of so many things. And post October 7th, We saw something that was relatively new in the sense that organizations, nonprofits, initiated
The conversations.
testimony collection weeks within October 7th, inviting people to give live testimony. Some organizations focused only on women, others, it was, men, women, everybody. But the purpose was A, to collect historical data so that
Yes.
down, in a few years' time, when historians or researchers, they will have a rich database of testimonies. But it was also with the understanding that the sooner you talk about the trauma,
The better.
the better. And the faster you can start healing. Because if you sentence yourself, or the society around you sentences you to silence, then you have to carry this. And it's like a monster that keeps feeding, inside you. So I think this assumption that it decades must pass before survivors of violence, of war, will speak up. And that it is actually for many of them, maybe not for all of them, but for many of the victims, it actually makes all the sense in the world to speak up sooner rather than wait for decades.
You
But
know, sorry to interrupt you, but in the Cyprus context, because it wasn't spoken about, a lot of the victims of sexual violence actually committed suicide because they couldn't cope with the shame. And it was a double shame because it was, well, a Turk raped you. Okay, so I mean, why would I go there where a Turk has been? It was the shame of the society and it was the shame of the families. It was actually a triple rape. So there was no way you could actually step out of it because you were lost. Any way you looked at it, you were lost. There was no way you could step out of it because you got raped. Which is why I
But you
like
know,
what this French woman says, let's move the shame to the perpetrator.
yeah, but you know, so sexual violence in conflict is has been around since there were people in the
Yeah.
world. Okay, we find evidence of it in the Iliad and Odyssey. You find it in the Bible, right? You find it in other historical records, and the because under patriarchy, and we are all still living
Under
under
patriot.
patriarchal systems, if you violate the women, you're destroying the community,
Yes.
right? Because the women are the one who carry the honor and the resilience of the community in their physical bodies. And one of the things, I think that if we really, and I am ambitious. I am ambitious, and I practice radical hope, and I also am humble enough to know that I will not see all of this happen in my lifetime. But to go back to the beginning of our conversation about political motherhood and caring about creating a sustainable world, right, for generations to come, I think that the real dramatic change, the sort of radical change, will be when we understand that there's no that if a woman or a girl is raped in the context or sexually abused in another way in the context of a violent conflict, there's no shame, and the community will not
Fall apart.
fall apart if it actually provides these women and girls with the nurturing and the caring and the support that they need. It may actually make them even stronger as a community. But that's a very profound change that
That
needs to
that's transformation at its ultimate.
it's transformative. But I'm thinking, so my great grandmother was raped by Cossacks in
Okay.
the early 20th century. She became pregnant from this rape. She had two daughters. My grandmother was the eldest, and she became pregnant, and the rabbis told my great grandfather that he must divorce her, because according to Judaism,
The mother carries.
she has been with another man.
Okay.
And so he didn't have the guts to face her, so he sent a messenger with the divorce documents, and she had a breakdown.
I'm not surprised.
She had a breakdown. It's like a tragic, a Greek tragedy. She went down in the freezing cold to the river and threw and tore out her wedding gown and threw it down the river. And then she got terribly sick and she was hospitalized. And my grandmother, who was the eldest, would walk in the cold and the rain and the snow to visit her ailing mother, as well as care for her younger
Siblings.
sisters. So, and this story was kept a secret in the family for decades until my grandmother told it to my father. And when they were driving alone in the car from to Jerusalem. But for many years, the story was only whispered. It wasn't told in the family until my amazing aunt, before she died, she wrote her memoir and she wrote down the story. And I was thinking, how this story resonated with me. And I did not know my great grandmother, right? Because, but my grandmother always carried this deep sadness. And it's like, this trauma that goes from one generation to another of this,
It's the intergenerational trauma,
this
people
profound
underestimate
loss
it.
and intergenerational trauma. And so I think that, and this goes back to formative listening, that what often happens is that when women are raped by the enemy, this fuels revenge. We must now avenge. We must now, it's payback,
Yes.
which doesn't heal anybody. It just inflicts.
It serves no purpose. Revenge serves no purpose.
It inflicts more pain and more suffering, and it doesn't heal the victims. And so, what would happen if we say we should now take the time to listen, to provide the space for the survivors to heal, to make it known to everybody that there's no shame here, and they shouldn't feel shame or a responsibility, carrying this burden on their shoulders, and that they don't need to prove anything. But I think again that this calls for a feminist view of conflict, right? This calls for, our task in this world is to minimize human suffering, not exacerbate it. Our mission is to try and very patiently from one generation onto another to show that revenge is not a natural response, right? It's not like a force of nature. It's not a volcanic eruption. Revenge is a mental mechanism
That we need to reprogram.
that we need to reprogram, we need to rewire, our collective consciousness. There's a beautiful poem. I'll try to find the in the English version of it, by a Palestinian poet, Muhammad de Tahal, and it says it's called Revenge, and it's an amazing poem. It's an amazing poem. But there's also a proverb in Arabic that says, if I'm going to avenge, if I'm going out to take revenge on the on a person who hurt me or my family, I should dig two graves, one for him
And
and
one
one
for me.
for myself. And so I think that sort of rewiring our sort of our mental perception, right? And understanding that if we really care about this world and about the people living in it, then our mission would be to minimize conflict and not to depict revenge, retaliation, or any other military
Reaction.
reactions as a natural reaction. Certainly not the only natural reaction, because the truth is that fighting back is a natural reaction only when our brain is shut down and the only thing functioning is the amygdala, right?
Yes,
This is
yes.
like the fight flight, right? But when our brain is fully functional, right, then we see options. Now, it's true that I think that following the October 7th Hamas attack and then the retaliation, the ongoing Israeli retaliation in Gaza, they certainly, you can certainly see how this
Has not
put
worked.
the collective mind is not thinking straight.
No.
It's thinking in terms of, am
Payback.
I food or are you food,
Yes.
basically? Am I the hunter or the prey, right? Am I the predator or the prey?
Yes.
And I
But
think,
I
go
think
ahead.
this is a good part to bring in what you mentioned about earlier about political parenting, because if there was the context, the concept of we actually aspire to be political parents, what happened following October 7th would not have happened. And I'm using October 7th as an example because there are examples all over the world. Because if we actually believe that and we've discussed this before we started recording, I'm not a parent just because I have a child. I'm a parent because I'm a human being that wants to leave behind a world. Or not leave behind, I want to create a world that all of us have a space to live in a dignified manner, to have access to water, healthcare, education, and whatever. So tell me a little bit about this, a little bit more about this political parenting, because I think it's something we need to work at. Because looking at the world around me, I despair because I think, how do we get out of it? How do we change this mindset that the Hamas did this to me, so I've got to get them back, or the Houthis did this to me, so I've got to get them back? In all the conflict, how do we step out of this thing that it's payback? Payback is the only way to deal with some kind of conflict or violation or whatever term you want to use.
So I think, first of all, I think it's a question of, do you have a sense of agency? And to go back to, am I food or are you food? But if I'm in a state of mind where I understand that there are options, it means I understand I have agency and I have the agency to choose. Now, this week, even in Israel, there was talk about the horrible starvation in Gaza. And the starvation inflicted on Gaza, especially babies and children.
I mean, I watch those pictures
And
and
the
I.
images, the world is seeing the images, and Israel is becoming increasingly diplomatically isolated because children, people are looking at these pictures and they're beside themselves. And I don't know why, but you know how our mind works. And I was thinking of all the folk and fairy tales about the wicked stepmothers. So in Hänsel and Gretel, she tells the father, the biological father, by the way, to send the kids off to the woods to die because they don't have enough food. And there's the wicked stepmother in the juniper tree, which is an Irish folk tale, where she kills the boy and she feeds him to the father. Folk tales are, they're so gory. But I was thinking, if any normative person would hate the wicked stepmother, right? Passionately hate a woman who sentences innocent children to die of hunger or being devoured by animals in the woods, right? You would, right? She's despicable.
Totally. I mean, who does that?
But when you look at what is happening to the collective consciousness of many Israelis, is, and this is so sad because these are mostly good people who have completely lost the capacity for compassion. And so, and to the very basic, paradigm, the children are innocent, no matter who they are and no matter what their national or ethnic or racial affiliation is. This shouldn't be part of any
Conflict.
conflict, right? So I think that political motherhood is grows out of this very basic paradigm that we should care about all children because all children are innocent,
Yes.
regardless of what their parents have done or have not done,
And of where they live or they don't live, they
and
are
where they
all.
live, and in that sense, it's not about you don't have to be a woman with a womb who gave birth to a baby. You can be a woman who adopted a child, and you could be a man.
Exactly.
Political motherhood or political parenting is about the commitment to care deeply about all children because our responsibility as adults is to protect all children and create a world where all children can thrive, right? Now, it's possible, I look at my own children and what I am able with the means that I have to offer them. And then I can say, but I want all children to have access to the opportunities, to the education, to the care, to the availability of medical care that my children have access to, right? So I'm a part of a group called Mothers Against Violence. It's a group that started out 5 years ago, and our initial goal was to protect protesters from police brutality. And then we expanded it to protecting Palestinians in the occupied territories from settlers' violence and military violence. And then we were the first to give away the yellow ribbons for the safe return of all the hostages. And to me, finding a group of women, but also men, who embraced my concept of political motherhood with such enthusiasm was amazing. It's like I found
A new family.
because, these are the people, they said, yeah, makes total sense. And that's why, men can be part of the group, and because the truth is, it's really not about biology.
No, it
And I have
isn't.
to say, sadly, working with survivors of terrible violence in childhood, sometimes biological parents will hurt their children in unimaginable ways. And people who have no biological connection to them will be their guardian angels and will be the good fairies that, So I think that it's really, Carol Gilligan has a beautiful quote that says that under patriarchy, care is a feminine ethic. But under democracy, care is a human ethic. Okay. So I think that if we are able to transform our societies, to shift from towards the non-patriarchal patterns, then we're good. I think it's at least half the work, okay? And it will take time. It will take time. I think we have come an extremely long way, right? We have come a very long way. We still have a very, very long way to go. My generation is standing on the shoulders of the giants that came before
Before.
us, and I'm already seeing the younger generations of feminists who are totally amazing. But I think that if we want to change the way people think of the world and the way people think of conflicts, then we need to dismantle patriarchy, basically.
Oh, no doubt about it. But because we've come to the end of the podcast, I think my takeaway, and I'm really glad I've met you for this, but not only for this particular reason, I think the major shift we need to make is this political parenting. Because I think when you make that shift, it'll definitely lessen this knee-jerk reaction. Well, they kick me, so I've got to kick them back.
Yes.
And it's also got to shift away from whether the child is Palestinian, Israeli, Ukrainian, Russian, Yemeni, Congolese, or Haitian, doesn't make a difference. Every child has the right to access to health, to water, to food, to shelter, to freedom from violence, to education. They all have the right to live in a safe space.
Absolutely.
And I
Amen
think
to
that,
that.
yes, amen, inshallah, whatever. But to me, that's the big takeaway we should all be saying, because this is a horrible, when you look around, it's a horrible world we live in. Violence everywhere. So we have to try and move away from the patriarchal knee jerk and move towards the political parenting, which is not feminine, it's human.
Exactly.
Okay. Kamutal, thank you very much for this
Okay.
inspirational conversation. And let's stay in touch. And the message
Okay.
to the listeners, please try and practice political parenting. We need to find a way to move forward, and we need all our children to be okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Hamutal, and to the
Thank
listeners,
you,
thank you
Magda.
for
Thank you
listening.
so much.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.